Adventist Young Professionals presents the following breakout session as part of the 2025 Behold Convention. We hope you enjoy this session and the entire series of inspiring presentations.
Jesus, thank you for lunch. Thank you for this afternoon. I pray that you would be with us as we talk about things that matter in life. And I pray that you would teach us, I pray, in Jesus' name, amen. So culture building, and culture is a funny word, like, you know, we always talk about it, but it's like, what's the vibe of the place you work? Like, what's the vibe of the group? So, and again, I think about church, school, healthcare organizations, any company, like just any group of people. And what is it, particularly when you're leading it or you're somehow involved in leading a group of people, how do you, good? Perfect. So there's a lot out there on culture building, but I want to just blitz through some things that I've thought about. And some of this is going to be in a higher education context because that's where I've recently talked about some of it. But I think that there's a lot of transferability. So let me just go through a list of things that to me, if you're building a culture and organization, matter. And I think I've got five or six of these. So first of all, to me, mission and a strong, compelling why is critical. Okay. My wife's a marathoner, by the way. She's the one that, you know, she hikes great mountains and all this. And I don't do all of that necessarily. But when we were first dating, maybe it was when we were early married, but she was like, we're going to go climb the South Sister, which is the second highest peak in the state of Oregon. And I researched it and it's like, it gets a 10 out of 10 for beauty in this book I saw, 10 out of 10. And then it has another metric, and that's how rigorous this thing is. Well, lucky me, it was a 10 out of 10 on their rigorous hikes. So it's just one of these deals, right? So I remember, because she's in really good shape, I remember suffering, being about 30 paces behind her the entire climb. And every step, I was just exhausted. And I remember asking myself a question. Every step, I was just the same question over and over and over. And what was that question? Why? 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 You know, over and over, just why? You know, and then I would answer my question, you know. It is beautiful out here, you know. Why? It is. I am getting good exercise. Why? I'd like to stay in a relationship with this woman, you know. So, but life's uphill. In case you didn't know that already, life's uphill and it never stops on planet Earth. It's uphill. It's always challenging. It's always stressful. You know, as long as sin's around, it's challenging and it's always uphill. And so I like that little story. It's helped me realize that the only way you're going to keep trudging through life with all the disappointments and the challenges and particularly in the workplace is you got to have some clear sense of why. And if you're going to hold a group of people together on a really bad work day or when the church is about, whatever it is, you got to have a why. Otherwise, you're going to stop putting one foot in front of the other. So I like to talk to our crew about why. I'm going to give you an example of the kind of the things that I do, and you can use whatever samples you want. So when I talk to our crew about higher education, which is really hard, Adventist higher ed is really hard work, right? And people don't get paid very much and it's stressful. I mean, the whole thing, right? So I remind them, this is a Lebanese philosopher, our Lebanese philosopher and diplomat, Christian. And he wrote a generation ago, the great Western institution, the university, dominates the world today more than any other institution, more than the church, more than the government and all other institutions. We are dealing with the power that dominates the world. And I read this to them in their context to remind them, you're working for the most influential industry that there is. And I'm really hyperbolic with it, right? I'm like really charging them up. And particularly when much of higher education has shown Jesus the door and doesn't want anything more with God, I remind Walla Walla University, not only are you the most powerful organization in the world, but we've got God at the center of it. So think about, you get to work for that kind of organization. What a powerful why. Does that make sense? I'm wanting them to, when they show up this fall again, I won't show them this slide, but I will have some rendition of reminding them, you work in the most critical place on the planet, kind of a talk. Now, if I were giving that talk to a group of pilots, I would be doing this. I'd be doing the same. It wouldn't matter the group. I want them to think and to realize why what they're doing is so important. So I show them statistics about all the money that's invested and wasted there, but we're not going to do it. I remind them of the history, whether it's University of Virginia or this book that talks about the role of higher education in the present, or Bowdoin College. I go through this list. I look through Ellen White's stuff on education, about why education is so important. That stars where Walla Walla University is, by the way. I show them this slide about all of the graduates that we send out in the American West and how that impacts the church. I show them this slide about all the employees we send out to the five Adventist healthcare systems around the country and why that matters. But basically, I plow through. I show them this picture, which is on our campus, which is our School of Engineering, and how the church is at the heart of it. You can see the reflection of the church. So I basically go through over and again and remind them why they're doing what they're doing matters. So the first thing this afternoon, I would say, is just whatever you're up to, you got to constantly remind people why it matters. It's critical. And again, to me, it's critical because if you're not getting paid, if you had your heart broken, if work's kind of blah, if the church is, you know, there's 100 reasons to stop walking and to stop hiking. And to me, if you don't have this thing locked in, you're in real trouble. And this motivates people too. And so I think discovering what the why of your organization is, it gives you a rallying cry that says we're doing something really important. Now, I think some organizations, like if you're in pediatrics and you're caring, I mean, that might be more direct. I'm helping a kid who's suffering. That could be really direct. But the further you get away from that, it could be tricky because you're like, well, why does, I don't know. Does it really matter that I'm restocking shelves at Walmart or whatever it might be? And so I think every profession is going to have its own uniqueness, but I do think reminding people, and even doctors, by the way, when I worked for Adventist Health, I would sit with a group of physicians and I would talk to them about how we think you guys are godlike and, you know, we're the most vulnerable. You're never more vulnerable than when you're around your physician. I mean, is that true? You're often physically naked. You may be hurting, suffering, the truth about your body's being told. And so I would fire up the physicians and go, that's the most sacred moment that could ever happen on planet Earth. But I want a group to understand why. So to me, a culture starts with this. And once this is locked in and you have to remind constantly, I think you start to get some traction. The second thing I think is really important is to Sabbath. And as Adventists, we think about the seventh-day Sabbath. But Sabbath is the seventh day. Amen. And it's also a whole way of thinking about life. So it's not just about a day, it's a whole way of thinking about time. It's the creation of time. And it means that we carve out sacred time for important things. So I have this idea that I've worked with for many years called courageous calendaring, because we tend to be cowards with our calendars, I want to submit to you. Meaning, I don't know, I'm just swamped. I don't have time to do it. Like, we're just like, we act like our calendars are the boss. So courageous calendaring is no. So here's some of the things I think that are important here. The Gallup organization has looked at employee engagement for years, you know, millions of surveys, you know, thousands of companies across the country and around the world. And what's interesting is when they look at the top 12 reasons that employees feel engaged, meaning they're in a good culture, look at this list. It's really interesting. You know, what's expected of me at work, materials and equipment I need. I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day. In the last 7 days, I've received recognition. My supervisor cares about me. You know, there's someone at work who encourages me. My opinions matter. The mission or purpose of the company makes me feel my job's important. That's kind of what I just talked about. Associates or fellow employees are committed to doing quality work. I have a best friend. Someone has talked to me about my progress. I've had opportunities to learn and grow. So you kind of get the feel. Well, when you look at it, I'm knocking out the first three and the last one. They're all these sort of deeply relational things, which is fascinating to me. They're not about pay. They're about people, including I have a best friend at work. This idea of real relational connection. As it turns out, we love to be in places where we feel really connected to people. I mean, who would have thunk it? You know, probably the biggest, when you look at the data, the reason people leave the Adventist church, by the way, is often not for theological disagreement. It's because they don't have any human connection. So anyway, so if you just look at those, you see all those relationships. You want that closer to me? Right there? It pops when I get around it. Is that good? Good enough? All right. I'll try to behave myself. So some of the ways that I try to Sabbath my calendar, you know, courageously, is to build in time. So let me give you some examples. When I was an executive with Adventist Health, my immediate team, and they hated me for this, but they learned to love it, is we met at 7:55 every single morning. Now, we started work technically at 8 o'clock, but we were religious about starting at 7:55. And what did we do for those 5 minutes? Prayed together, connected, make sure everybody's doing okay. It was an absolute must that we met together at 7:55. Now, the group hated the boss for a while, but we learned to covet that time because it was time that we were enjoying together. Every week, religiously, we carved out 90 minutes as a group. I am not one who believes in efficient meetings. Now, I believe in efficient meetings, but I also think a good chunk of those 90 minutes should be carved out for inefficient interaction between people.
Like a check-in.
A check-in. How's it going? Telling a joke, back and forth, you know, what's going on? So I don't mean inefficient. I mean, there needs to be inefficient time built into this. So, for example, my current sort of president's cabinet, we carve out the first 30 to 40 minutes of the meeting. It's basically praying, talking, etc. So I'm controlling it so it's not out of control, but I would rather spend more of an emphasis on the people connections in the meeting and less on the actual business transformation. I can do business transformation in an email. Are you with me? I can communicate information 1,000 ways. The one thing I can't do with my team is interact with them through email or through other means. So I view the getting together on the group as primarily about human connection and secondarily about business progress. Because there's other ways I deal with the business, one-on-one meetings, strategy meetings, or whatever. So I want the Wednesday spiritual autobiographies. This is something that we did at Adventist Health, where this was at the corporate office. We had a half an hour worship every Wednesday, and we called it spiritual autobiographies, where people would come basically give testimonies about what God was doing in their area of the company. Now, you can't do this if you work for a company that's not Christian. I get that there's, you know, analogies here, but we were afforded that opportunity and we took it. That's an expensive meeting, friends. Takes several hundred people at healthcare market wage, half an hour of their time at, do the math. That's what we call an expense. That's an expensive meeting. That's a lot of employee time, but it was really critical. If you're going to Sabbath, you got to invest in it and trust that God will deal with the productivity. We did a mission formation day every quarter. This is taking a full day of building time together, eat together, pray together, work on core values. Interdepartmental lunches is something we did. This is where silos would get broken down, mini retreats. Always, my phone's sitting down there. I probably have 1,000 birthdays in my phone. I would urge you to have every single person that works with you and for anybody in your orb have their birth. Do you know what it meant this morning when I texted one of my employees and said happy birthday? It took me 15 seconds. But it was the boss, the president, cares about me. I can't do that if I'm just like in Houston. I can only do that if I have a disciplined way and I use my phone that way. Is I have all their birthdays in there with their phone numbers. Does that make sense? It's gold for people when you remember them on their birthdays. And I try never to miss a funeral. As annoying as that can be sometimes for your schedule, people never forget when you were there for them in a time of crisis. Biweekly one-on-ones, etc. Silos you want to break down. I'm going to skip through a couple of these. There was this famous thing in Wisconsin in the mid part of the 20th century where they would take children who'd been orphaned and they would isolate them. This is actually a pediatric study. And they would isolate these kids because they didn't want them to get sick. But what they found is by isolating the kids, they were getting sicker. Okay? And what they found was that the solitary confinement, the problem with it was not that it was boring or static or lacks opportunities for cognitive stimulation, although all that is true and none of that is good. The more serious problem for the children was there was no one to love them or like them or just smile and give them a careless hug. It was this isolation from human touch and affection that was destroying the children's ability to fight infection. At the center of the argument is a simple statement: for a child, love is necessary survival. So the picture you saw back there of the monkey and things, for example, they were isolating these creatures. And what they discovered is if you don't have loads of love in human contact, things fall apart quick. So love is necessary for survival. This is a big theme in the places that I work. I want people to enjoy being together. If you're isolated, you are in trouble. The culture is going downhill. So number one mission, why am I showing up? Keep reminding people of that, no matter where you work. Why is this important? Second, courageous calendaring. Make sure you're building in social connections with the people you're working with. But then it's not just connecting, it's going deep with them relationally. I'm going to skip through this. This is how I kind of see the way we talk to each other at work, and maybe even in this room. I'll do an experiment. So we talk about the weather. We do a lot of talking about the weather. Man, it's hot and humid outside in Houston in July. My goodness. What's the weather like? Weather, right? We talk about the weather and other conversations that are basically at that level. We spend a lot of time talking to human beings about the weather. Now, if we're courageous enough, we might talk about, well, there's a problem or something's broken, or, we might push a little bit deeper. Or maybe, hey, we might talk about pickleball or flag ball or tennis or, a pickup basketball game, or we might talk about recreation. Movie we saw or something, might push it a little bit deeper. Or then maybe even deeper, we might talk about theology or religious ideas or some, political idea or something deeper, right? Serious conversation. But ultimately, I think if we just keep it at these sort of levels and don't kick into this level where we're actually talking about suffering and joy, it's very difficult to build culture. You and I don't love anybody in our lives if we haven't had conversation, if people don't know why we suffer and what brings us joy. Otherwise, it's much more surfacey conversations. Does that make sense? So how do I welcome real conversations about suffering and joy into the place that I work? How do I see people when they're hurting? How do I see them when they have a moment of joy? How do I move into that space? I think people feel really lonely and they end up leaving places where you're only dealing with the weather and work problems and recreation and religious ideas and things. If they don't feel any sense for 8 hours a day that they're having any real conversation at lunch, at the end of the day or something. I'm going to skip through a couple of these. Relationships, deep knowing, it requires conversation where we're actually connecting with each other. Character, brave accountability. I think this is big for culture. So I'll give you an example from higher education and you can think about it. So think about the academic community. So this is where I work. So just put your company or organization there in the center. And basically, if you work in an academic community, you have people inside that circle. There we are. And outside that circle, you have people that are weighing you. So if you see the balance scaler, they're judging you. This is what they do. So let me tell you some of the people that judge me. A bunch of 18-year-olds. They're freshmen in college. What do you think they're doing? They're judging us. They pay to judge us, but they're judging us, right? They're evaluating. And now I tell my two kids who are teenagers, I grew up in the 80s. They're like, Dad, don't wear that or that piece of music. I'm like, Audrey William, I grew up in the 80s. By definition, I'm cool. So I don't really care what you have to say. So I kind of throw it back at them. But no, but so we've got 18-year-olds that are, something doesn't go right, right? They'll hold us accountable for it. We've got accrediting bodies. So think of this as, you know, whatever body accredits you, you know, your, whether it's the FAA or whether it's, you know, healthcare or the state of Florida or whatever it might be, right? We have, so they're judging us. Then you have other stakeholders out there that have either financial interest or they have, you know, whatever, but you know, there's other people that are judging your organization. And then you have, I would just call unsolicited critics. These are people that, you know, they're the kind of people that fill out the surveys. Now, if I'm offending anyone here, I never fill out surveys. I don't know. Even when I have good things to say, I never fill them out. I'm too lazy or something. But you know what I'm saying? Like, so you have all these critics on the outside, and it doesn't matter where you work, they're pushing in. Your customer, I mean, this would be the equivalent of like your customer, you know, your the people that have financial interest. These are regulators, and then they're just random people. They're all going to push on you and your company. My company, Wawa University right now, all that's happening. Every day, all day, there's the potential for some outside critic. And what does that do to those of us inside the circle? It's pressure. So whether you're the pastor of a church or teacher in the class, it doesn't, you know, you're, whatever you're doing, that's pressure that you're feeling from all of those external evaluations. And you may feel like they're fair, unfair, but it doesn't matter. They're still going to feel like pressure. So the only way I know how to deal with that, because you're not going to eliminate all those external groups. You don't want to eliminate them because you'd be out of business. You actually have to engage them. So the only way to move from this, where you see those arrows of pressure cranking in, is you have to reverse it and you have to take the balances. There you go. That's the standards, right? The character. And you have to build that in. And then all of these other folks are on the outside and you're actually, the feeling changes completely is my point. I've seen this happen where I can look back and go, actually, our standard is even higher than the one that you're demanding. Does that make sense? It's not just a psychological trick, although it works psychologically, but it's, I actually want higher standards than those folks on the outside. And that puts me in a whole different position. So when the accrediting bodies come that evaluate whether we could stay in business come, if we already have academic standards and equity standards for our students, and if we already are holding ourselves accountable to a high standard, that eliminates, you know, that kind of takes that away as an issue. If the critic comes, you know, and says, well, I don't think you're doing enough religiously on campus. And I can say, well, we have 80,000 hours of student-led worships every year, and we have 46,000 credit hours of, you know, of Bible, you know, and if we have a plan already from the inside, that changes everything at that point, because we've set that higher standard. But I think it means that we should have a conversation as a team on a regular basis about what do the high standards that we want to live into look like. And sometimes it means little things. So just a couple little things, then we'll open up for conversation. So my family, the four of us, we went to a restaurant a few years ago, sit down, order our beverages. I go to the restroom. And while I'm in the restroom, these two guys go in there and they use the facilities for what they're there for. And then they leave without washing their hands. Now, that troubled me, but it mainly troubled me because they were wearing chef's outfits. You see the problem. And so I finished my business and washed my hands, went back, and I said to the family, let's go. I'm like, Dad, what? Said, in the car, we'll talk. What? Go to the car, put some money down, you know, paid for the drink or whatever, drop some cat, like get to the car. Because what happens in the bathroom is just as important as what happens in the kitchen. Does that make sense? And that's part of this rigorous accountability, is pushing folks to understand that it's when people aren't watching that the standard has to be at that level. Does that, like, you want to push towards that level of character. As religious people, it's great to stand up front and sing the worship songs and preach the doctrines. But if I'm not walking the walk more deeply, it will show up at work. You can't put a costume on when you show up to work. That kind of integrity has to flow all the way through, I think. So I just think this is huge when you look at building character. By the way, I think this means that everybody's got to take ownership for everything. It means that everybody's got to be in the business of picking up trash at work. Everybody's got to be in the business of being part of the PR team. Everybody, you know, that across the board, you're trying to build, you know, an organization of real integrity. I think this is critical. I think that you start to get culture build when you have a clear and compelling why, when you're taking quality time in the schedule to be with people, when you're willing to have deeper conversations with the folks you're working with, and then when you establish a kind of a brave accountability that always rises above your customer. That's the key. Always rises above. Okay. And then I think in the end is you want to elevate hospitality. So you're interacting with people and you kind of want to surprise somebody by going the extra mile. So I'll finish with this story, then we'll have a conversation. So when I was working in healthcare, I was running late to a meeting, suit, tie, badge that, you know, had the word president on it, the whole thing, right? So I'm thinking very important things about myself and I'm running late to a meeting. And I realized that the fastest way to get to this meeting room is through the emergency department, right? The emergency room doors. And so I fly through these doors, the glass doors open up into the waiting room. And you know the scene, full of humans, old and young, sick, broken. Some really need to be there. Some don't, but in American healthcare, they have nowhere else. In American society, they have nowhere else to go sometimes. So that's their living room. So you just picture the scene, right? Full of people. I am moving at pace. And all of a sudden, as I'm moving, I come to a screeching halt and I feel this tension on my suit coat. And it just is taut like this. And I look down and there's a human hand that has grabbed my suit coat. And the human hand is connected to an arm that's connected to an old lady who's sitting in a wheelchair. And she's not letting go. And I'm thinking, oh, my Father in heaven, why is this happening to me? Like, please, why is this? But I'm not going anywhere. And she looks up to me and I will never forget the exact word. She goes, Sonny, that's what she called me. She said, Sonny, I need an orange soda. And now I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. In my head, right? I'm like, this is what on earth did I walk into? And I realize I noticed that there's a drink machine, soda machine, like about 30 feet away over there. And I'm like, thank goodness. And I look over, then I look back at her and she's just going like this. Nope. She's already checked out that drink machine. They're not there. That's not one of the options apparently over there. She thrusts this crinkled dollar bill up in my hands and goes, Sonny, I need an orange soda. So you know how hospitals are. They're always built like in 94 different stages. Like you can never find anything, right? And it's like floor to floor and elevator, and then it never matches, right? It's just, and I'm like nurse's station, break room, you know, this soda. It takes me like 25 minutes and I finally find an orange soda. All the way back down to I'm thoroughly late at this point, all the way back down to this room full of hurting and broken people. And there's this older woman and I present her with her orange soda. I have rarely in my life seen a face so full of unbridled joy. I mean, it's just like this thing has washed over her. And she thanked me. I go to my meeting super late with all my, you know, professional importance. And I remember thinking a couple things. One is, I wonder if the medicine that woman needed most that day was that orange soda. And I also thought about how it could have been an ordinary day. And I've had a million, or well, maybe not a million, but, you know, thousands of ordinary days in a professional career. I got no stories to tell you for most of those days. None. There are days that came and went, came and went, came and went. What made that day memorable? It was the disruption that challenged me towards elevating hospitality for someone who was in need. That's what made work good that day. It wasn't making a good financial decision, or that it was that I had a moment to elevate hospitality for someone. And I often have wondered why Jesus, the first miracle of Jesus, are you all aware of what that was? Yeah, it's an orange soda story, right? One, wrong timing, he said, not God's timing, not what's supposed to be going on. Why is it? And yet he does it anyway. By the way, not on God's schedule, but does it anyway. I think that's really interesting that that's the first miracle. And it's a miracle of no real consequence. Nobody's eyes got working again. You know, nobody's legs got fixed. Nobody got raised from the dead. I mean, if you follow what I'm saying, I'm not saying it wasn't important, but it was. And I wonder if that's not the first miracle of Jesus to remind us of the need to be interrupted at an inopportune time to elevate hospitality for people who need a smile on their face. And I think if you don't build that into this idea of building organizational culture, work will just become the mechanics of, I left on time, I landed on time. I started on time, I finished. Does that mean it will? What am I doing at that point? Like, what am I doing? We enrolled students this September and we graduated them in June and I shook their hands on the way out. I'm oversimplifying it, but I'm like, if it's just the mechanics of what you're doing and you miss these God moments, you miss these, and God moments are almost always elevating hospitality, by the way. When we talk about God moments, they're almost always about some powerful human interaction when you hear someone tell a story about a God moment. And I just think when you have a clear why and you're carving out time for people and you're willing to have deep conversations and you have a lot of accountability, not from the outside, but from the inside, and then you're really taking these moments to be interrupted, then I think you're, to use the phrase, you're cooking with gas, right? You're really starting to flow in terms of building the culture. All right. I did a lot better job being quiet early this session than I did last time, which gives us 12 minutes or so for you to share your wisdom. So what say you? You got to pass the mic? Okay. Easier for me to repeat? I'll pass the mic. Who's going?
I have a question. So I'm thinking about my leadership team, and they're coming back in 2 weeks from their summer vacation. I'm a program director for a nonprofit called Literacy Now. And I used to be a school administrator and teacher. And so with the team, one-on-one, I'm thinking about relationships. It's good with me individually with them, the coffee chats, things like that. But when we are in the team meeting and we do like the check-in at the beginning, standard agenda item, all's well, good, good, good. And it's very surface still. And I'm trying to figure out how do I get them to feel more comfortable with each other. Although I've built the personal relationships with them, how to facilitate that, because some are more transparent and I try to model that. But there are a few that I can think of that are a little bit more guarded. And it's like, this is just work. And I don't want to be too pushy about that.
How many are on your team? Eight, this is perfect. So if I have eight people around a table and I want them to engage, it's a little bit like when you have a church and you say, turn to a person next to you and say, hi. It may work, it may not. The way that I've seen it work is you give them something to do. So if you have a team of eight around a circle, I would do a couple things. One, I would say, before we get started, I want everybody to think about something really great about the person sitting to your right. So imagine you're sitting in a circle. Okay, I'm going to give you just a second. Think about something that you think they just really bring to the team and do well. And we're going to go around the circle. I have seen that just be magical. It does a couple things. One, everybody talks with that. Two, I'm kind of on the hook to say something that lifts up the person sitting next to me and then that person around the table. Does that make sense? I found that that kind of exercise gets them, because the problem you're describing is real, which is we often have these good vertical relationships as boss and the people that are reporting to you, but how do I get them horizontally in the structure to build relationships? I think you have to ask a specific question, like, or a specific activity. I want you to think about something that you really think the person to your right really does well. Or if you have more time, I've opened it up and said, we're going to take 5 minutes per person around. We're just going to spend, what's your name?
Keenan.
We're going to spend 5 minutes, the whole team, and we're just going to tell Keenan all the things we love about her. I had people crying, people like with smiles on their face. Like, there's something about that level of interaction that, you know, I think gets percolating. But I think asking them a specific question. And it doesn't always have to be that. It could be, if you want to do it lighter to start with, you could say, somewhere you've been in the world that everybody's got to go. Is that, or you've played these games before, but I think it's about being specific. That's why, like at church, when it's like, well, meet and greet, I would prefer to say, turn to someone next to you, and I want you to tell them one thing they've got to eat in this town, something they got to eat that's so good, you got to share that joy this Sabbath morning. You'll get conversation at this level versus this level because we're all like insecure. I am. I'm like around people. I'm like, I don't know. What am I going to say? Give me something to say. Now it adds to that comfort. Does that get you going? But I would just, man, absolutely. I think getting them talking about one another positively, it's great. It's gold. Again, I've seen more tears of joy in people through just that activity. What else? Good.
Okay. So that's the leadership team. Their subordinates, the rest of our staff, comes back in the end of August. And I'm thinking about, like, the why. How do you make that... I guess because I have a teacher brain, like engaging where I'm not saying the same thing every single year, like you're finding a way to make it different and reignite them.
Yeah. So maybe you can coach me on this because it's a challenge. I think it's both. In other words, I want them to hear me saying the same things every single year, and I don't want them to get tired of hearing it. So it needs to be fresh, which is what you're basically saying. So I think a couple of ways you can do that. I'll give you a real world example. Cause my team comes back for the school year. We have the big meeting with like 300 employees on September 15, Monday. I'm collecting stories already of great things they've accomplished over the last year that I will push into that. So those are new. Does that make sense? I will still tell them things like, you've got the best, you know, you're working for the best organization in the world. It's the most important mission and God needs us to be, you know, we shape the future. I will still use some of the same reminders, but I think what's new is I've got stories of really cool things that they've been doing that illustrate that. Does that make sense? Or I'll also pull, I do a lot of reading. I'm sure you know, you're an educator, and I'm always looking for material that's fresh when I'm reading to put something new into the mix. But you know what they like best after I think about it? They like when I put a picture of them up there of something they've done. I mean, as much as I want to be fancy and academic, the thing they like most, and I use my iPhone all the time. When I'm here, I'm taking pictures. Your fearless leader, Tim, he's a graduate of Walwal University, right? I've already got a picture of him, you know, with me. Why? I'm going to use that this next fall to go, these are the kind of graduates we put out there that are leading really cool ministries. And I think as a leader, honestly, like throughout your year, I'm using that iPhone all the time. I wish I could show you all the pictures. I am every day I'm catching people doing good things. Does that make sense? I'm catching them praying. I'm catching them teaching. I'm catching them silly things. I don't care what it is. I got a picture of two Walla Walla University. We have an aviation program. I have two Walla Walla University pilots, a first officer and a pilot in the same cockpit flying a plane. That's pure gold for me. Does that make sense? Why would I not capture that? Because do you see what I'm saying? It's connecting. So I'm always on the lookout when I'm on campus, whatever campus or business campus you are. People respond when they think about it. They love seeing themselves. I'm going to have this idea to start where I'm going to put all 300 names or however many there are up on the screen at once as they're coming in. You probably have seen this at a conference or something. You know what? The look, it's like in lines. And anyway, why am I going to do that? Because people, they're going to come in and they're going to be like looking for their name. Does you follow what I'm saying? And even if it's eight, you have all their names up front, you know, at the beginning. We're just that way. So I think the more that you can use their own actions as motivation to do even more good actions, that I think it really starts to hum at that point. So is that helpful? I'm telling you, my iPhone is my leadership tool. I am constantly looking for quotes, pictures, interesting things. By the way, all of you in the room, if you communicate in any capacity, up front, whatever, your iPhone is your friend. I want to find anything that's interesting to me. I take a picture of it. I don't care if I ever know how I'm going to use it. I take a picture of it. If when I go to the airport tonight here, if there's something weird or funny or whatever in the airport, I will take a picture of it. I don't care what it is. I want a bank of ideas. That way, when I got to do talks and presentations, I'm just pulling from my own library. And the beauty of that is, by the way, it's not some stock photo that I ripped off online. It's mine. And if I show you a picture of, I don't know, the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., let's just say, and I ripped it from online, you will be bored out of your mind. If I said, man, I took this picture when I was in Washington, check this out, you'll have a completely different opinion about that picture because it's authentic. It was my trip I went on.
Are you wanting to buy it?
Well, since I got it.
Stay in your way.
starting some leadership things within the Pathfinder organization at my church. So, you already went through a lot of compelling ways to get your staff fired up, but you know, we're both working with kids, but you know, my kids are a little bit younger. Are there some things you would add for younger interactions with younger children with your staff?
So are you thinking about firing up the adults that are helping the kids or the kids themselves? Which category?
Mainly the staff, the kids too.
So with staff, you got to write a ton of thank you notes, number one. Don't ever underestimate the power of just thanking people. That's number one, is like, I write an awful lot of thank you notes. Sabbath morning, I have a list of people I text message, a whole stack every, sometimes, to be honest, I don't want to do it. It's work. So one, I would say, if you know who those staff are, a thank you note, a gift card, kind of figure out what their love language is, but I would start with those kinds of things. I love to grab a group on campus, you know, like say the English department, and just go, all right, when are we going to eat? You know, it just builds into them. Now that costs a few bucks, but a thank you note doesn't cost anything. I think little things like that. And then, I mean, what could be more important than being the leader of a Pathfinder group? You're taking young lives and you're instilling values into them that could change the entire world. Remind them of that, right? That uniform you wear isn't just about wearing a uniform. That means something very significant. And it's amazing how the power of being thanked. And, you know, I've taught college classes for 15 or 20 years. I can count two times a student has given me a little gift with a thank you note at the end of a class. I will never forget those students. There's something about, you know, just a little thank you note, a little card or something. There's something so powerful. So powerful about that. So I'd say thank you notes, little gifts, little reminders. Or I know we're at time right now. Sometimes it's about training. So if it's like somebody that's, if you can bring some value add to somebody. I just bought 6 books a couple days ago that I found on a certain topic that I'm going to gift one group of people because I'm like, oh, they would love this book, you know? And I think that can be something that also builds your culture. It grows people and it's a nice gift. At Christmas, by the way, I've done for teams for a long time now is I buy them each a unique book based on something about them. They love it. And by the way, it's so much fun to go on Amazon and just think, all right, creatively, how will she, what book would she really dig or what book would he would like? And so we all open them together and they all have a different book. And they're like, oh, the boss. I mean, if nothing else, they're like, the boss actually thinks about me. Yeah. And sometimes I'll do silly, but it'll be like a hobby of theirs or something silly. But I'm on time this time. I'm looking at my boss over here and I'm staring at the, but. Thank you. Appreciate it. Good question.
Thank you for joining us for this breakout session presented by Adventist Young Professionals as part of the 2025 Behold Convention. We invite you to explore the other sessions in this series and continue the journey with us.